From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Senator McCain argued that we could just, and I quote, muddle through in Afghanistan, and only came around to supporting my call for more troops last month.
Both Barack Obama and John McCain support sending more troops to Afghanistan. As the death toll escalates, we look at what the mainstream media is not reporting. Then trouble the water. As we near the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, a new documentary takes an in-depth look at the disaster.
They cannot say that they did not have the means. Our government is supposed to be one of the greatest, but it's proven to me that, hey, if you don't have money, you don't have status, you don't have a government.
But first, we go live to the Mediterranean Sea, where two boats have set sail en route to Gaza to break the Israeli blockade. We'll speak with the activists on board, including Lauren Booth, Tony Blair's sister-in-law. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. U.S. and Iraqi negotiators have agreed to a possible withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq by the end of 2011 and for a reduction in the presence of U.S. forces in Iraqi cities by the end of next year. The agreements come as part of a U.S.-Iraqi security deal to replace the U.N. mandate that expires in December. But the deal would also allow the U.S. to keep tens of thousands of troops in Iraq after 2011 for so-called supporting roles, including military training. No timetable has been reached for the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Iraq. Iraq's chief negotiator, Mohammed Ahaj Hamoud, said, quote, they have both agreed to 2011. If the Iraqi government at that time decides it's necessary to keep the American forces longer, so can do so. The Bush administration called the withdrawal timetables, quote, aspirational goals rather than fixed dates. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spent Thursday in Baghdad in negotiations.
Discussions on a number of other issues, including the Strategic Framework Agreement. It is an important agreement to allow Iraq and the United States to continue the cooperation that we've begun to lay a foundation for future cooperation.
Iraqi Foreign Minister Hosher Zebari said Baghdad and Washington are close to finalizing the deal.
We had a very good meeting with Secretary Rice. We discussed a number of regional Iraqi internal issues, and also we discussed the strategic framework agreement, that there has been a great deal of progress, in fact. Secretary Rice's meeting this morning with the Prime Minister was positive, and we are very close to finalize this important agreement.
Several issues remain unresolved, including whether U.S. troops will be subject to Iraqi law if accused of committing crimes. The New York Times reports it's also unclear whether the accord will allow for the U.S. to build permanent military bases in Iraq and what role the United States would play in providing air and naval support for Iraq. A major electronic voting company has acknowledged its voting system contains a critical programming error that can cause votes to be dropped and lost. The company, Premier Election Solutions, formerly known as Diebold, said the problem's been part of its software for 10 years, but was only recently identified. The flawed software is on both touchscreen and optical scan voting machines made by Premier, which supplies voting machines to 34 states. In Texas, a federal judge delayed the execution of Jeffrey Wood yesterday, pending an evaluation to determine if Jeff Wood is competent enough to be able to understand why he's being put to death. Jeffrey Wood was to have been executed last night for being an accomplice in a 1996 convenience store robbery. Wood was sitting in a truck outside when the clerk was shot and killed. The man who pulled the trigger was executed 6 years ago, but Wood was given a death sentence for the same crime under the Texas Law of Parties. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear our conversation with his family yesterday, just before the scheduled execution, as his mother, father, and wife sat outside the prison where he was waiting to die. In campaign news, speculations intensifying over who Senator Barack Obama will pick to be his running mate. On Thursday, Obama announced he's decided on a vice presidential candidate, but declined to provide a name. Obama said, quote, I want somebody who's independent, somebody who can push against my preconceived notions and challenge me. So we have got a robust debate in the White House. Obama's expected to announce his decision today or tomorrow by sending a text message to his supporters. In other campaign news, Senator Obama has begun airing a new television ad criticizing John McCain for failing to remember how many homes he and his wife own. During an interview with the website Politico, McCain was asked about his multiple homes.
How many houses do you and Mrs. McCain have?
I think I'll have my staff get to you. I'll kind of tell you about this. Okay, so condominiums are set further. I'll have them get to you.
Okay, thank you.
McCain's staff says the Arizona senator and his wife own four homes, two in Arizona, one in California, and one in Virginia. But it's reported the McCains actually own at least seven properties worth around $14 million. McCain's comments come just days after he said the threshold for considering someone rich is $5 million. He says he was kidding. In Pakistan, the death toll from Thursday's massive suicide bombing has reached at least 70. Three suicide bombers blew themselves up outside Pakistan's largest arms and ammunition factory. The bombing was the deadliest attack by the Taliban since they began hitting Pakistani government sites more than 18 months ago. A Taliban spokesperson called the arms facility, quote, a killer factory where arms are being produced to kill our women and children. The Taliban said the attack was in response to Pakistan's decision to launch a major military campaign in the Banjar tribal area. Over the past 3 weeks, more than 200,000 Pakistanis in the region have been forced to flee their homes because of the fighting. The Washington Post reports the Bush administration's announced plans to implement a controversial regulation designed to protect doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers who object to abortion or birth control from being forced to deliver services that violate their personal beliefs. The rule empowers federal health officials to pull funding from nearly 600,000 hospitals, clinics, health plans, doctors' offices, and other entities if they do not accommodate employees who refuse to participate in care they find objectionable on personal, moral, or religious grounds. Women's health advocates and family planning advocates condemned the regulation, saying it could create sweeping obstacles to a variety of health services, including abortion, family planning, end-of-life care, and possibly a wide range of scientific research. An Iraqi cameraman working for Reuters has been released after being held for 26 days without charge by the U.S. military. Ali al-Mashadani had been detained twice before by U.S. forces, at one time being held for 5 months, but no charge has ever been made against him. The trial of a former Marine accused of voluntary manslaughter and assault while serving in Iraq began yesterday. Jose Luis Nazario Jr. is charged with killing unarmed Iraqi detainees in Fallujah. If found guilty, he could face up to 10 years in jail. Nazario is the first civilian to be tried under a federal law that allows the prosecution of former military service members for war crimes. And in China, two activists with Students for Free Tibet staged what they called their Lucky Eight protests against the human rights situation in China during the Olympics. One of the activists, Ginger Cassidy, spoke to reporters in Beijing.
And we're here to stand in solidarity with the people of Tibet. Armed with human dignity and nonviolent tactics, they're going up against one of the largest propaganda and military machines in the world, China, who's been trying to dissolve any dissent in this country. We have organized over 8 nonviolent direct actions here while we've been in China successfully. We call it our Lucky Eights.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Two converted fishing boats set sail from Cyprus today, carrying 41 activists and humanitarian workers who are part of the Free Gaza movement that is trying to break the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip. The boats, the Liberty and Free Gaza, left the southern port of Larnaca this morning for the estimated 30-hour trip. Israel has warned the activists to steer clear of Gaza, which it says, quote, the subject of an Israeli Navy advisory notice that warns of foreign vessels from the designated maritime zone. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said in an open letter to the participants, quote, we assume that your intentions are good, but in fact, the result of your action is that you are supporting the regime of a terrorist organization in Gaza.
We're joined right now by one of the activists at sea on the boat Liberty. Huwaida Raaf is a human rights activist. She's co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement. She teaches human rights law at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Huwaida, tell us just where you are and when did you set sail?
We left the southern port of Larnaca at approximately 10 a.m. Our time. We are headed straight for Gaza. We are two vessels sailing without problems so far. The water is a little choppy, but everyone's in high spirits. If everything goes okay and we are not blocked by the Israeli Navy, we expect to be there within the next 24 to 26 hours.
And what do you hope to accomplish? What kinds of medical supplies do you have?
Well, we are carrying on board approximately 200 hearing aids that were requested by a society in Gaza for the children, because it's not very well known, but many of Gaza's children are going deaf because of the Israeli the sonic booms that they constantly let off over Gaza. They actually requested 9,000. We could not arrange it in this time. We're also carrying some urgently needed medical supplies. However, we are very adamant and clear that ours is not a humanitarian convoy, because we do not intend to keep putting Band-Aids on Gaza when what's happening is that Israel's policies are starving the people and causing them to basically cease to or just exist on handouts. And that's not what we're after. We are out to show that the people of Gaza have human rights and deserve to be able to make a living and not just live on handouts, because Israel completely blocks them from travel, blocks them from coming in and out, and completely controls their lives. And right now, they are trying to starve and humiliate an entire people.
Well, press reports in England have quoted the Israelis as saying that the Israeli government as saying that they regard you as no better than pirates. Have you had any direct contact with Israeli officials, or have any idea what you might expect in their response?
Well, that's ridiculous. We've been very open in our communication in as far as what we're doing and why we're doing it, and pointing out that Israel has grossly abused its authority as an occupying power. In 2005, Israel pulled its illegal settlements out of Gaza and now tries to claim that Gaza is free. But clearly, it has been rejected by the International Committee of the Red Cross and other international human rights and humanitarian organizations, because Israel still exercises effective control over Gaza. And we see that because Israel controls Gaza by air, sea, and land, which is why they're saying that they're going to block us from coming in. Now, so we have issued many communications, put all of our intentions on the website. We even, before leaving the port of Larnaca, we had the Cypriot port authorities check our boats to ensure that we are not carrying anything that we say that we didn't say we are carrying, that we don't have any weapons or any other contraband that constitutes a security threat to Israel at all. And we even issued a couple of weeks ago an invitation to the Israeli foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, to come with us if she's worried about a security threat, and to come with us to see what Israel's policies are actually doing to the people of Gaza. Now, they rejected that invitation and claim that they're going to blockade us anyway, but it's very clear that if they're going to blockade us, it's not for a security purpose. And that is why actually we're on this mission, because as an occupying force, Israel does control the Gazan waters. Now, we argue that Israel's occupation in itself has become illegal, because for over 41 years it has been in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, and Israel has abused its power by placing an entire civilian population, which Israel needs to be responsible for. You're responsible for the people that you occupy, their well-being, but Israel has completely abused its power and is starving the people of Gaza, and placing an entire population, 1.5 million people, it is collectively punishing them. This is not only illegal under international law, but it's also immoral, which is why we're setting out on this journey, because of the state that exists over the past couple of years that Israel has had this stringent siege over Gaza. 200 patients from Gaza have died because they have not been able to access the medical, to leave Gaza to access the medical care they need. 80% of the Gazan people, according to the United Nations, are living, cannot survive without handouts. You have hundreds of students that seek to pursue their education abroad that cannot leave. You have a horrendous sewage crisis because the Gazan people cannot import the materials they need to construct an adequate sewage system. So you have UN organizations claiming that pretty soon there might be an outbreak of waterborne diseases. You have fishermen that try to fish and get shot at when they go out more than 3 nautical miles. And so the situation is really unbearable, a man-made humanitarian crisis, and the international community, governments, institutions that are supposed to uphold people's human rights are not doing anything about it.
Huwaida Araf, can you describe who is on the two boats, the Liberty and the Free Gaza? We are trying to reach the other boat right now with Lauren Booth, Tony Blair's sister-in-law, journalist, and Jeff Halper, the Israeli professor of anthropology, coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. But who else is on these two boats?
Sure. We have approximately 43 civilians from 17 different countries. We have on the Liberty, which I'm speaking to you from, 18 people. We have a Greek member of parliament that was with us. The Greeks, which we started our journey from, has been very supportive, as have the Cypriot officials. We have, as you mentioned, Lauren Booth, Tony Blair's sister-in-law, and Jeff Helper, and many other average civilians. I think it's a really good representation of the international community. We have a doctor, we have lawyers, we have nurses, we have students, we have professors. Not necessarily big names, but concerned people from all over the world are just saying that we're not going to sit by and watch this happen.
Well, I just wanted to ask if by any chances we're talking to you, if you could tell people on your boat to tell the others we're trying to reach them. We'd reached them all morning. Now we're not able to reach Free Gaza, the other boat. But if you could tell them that, maybe they could, I don't know how you two communicate, the two different boats.
We do have satellite phones, which I'm speaking to you now from. We also have walkie-talkies, and we have the VHF system. So we have various means of communication.
Well,
we do not have a problem reaching them, but
we are right now. But could you also tell us, we've heard that you've gotten death threats before you left Cyprus. What is the situation? And that you had frogmen, police, checking out the bottom of the boat, Cypriot police, underneath the boats before you set sail.
Yes. Well, over the past couple of weeks, we've been into many harbors, and we have tried to be vigilant about security because we've learned from previous experiences, and specifically in 1988, the Palestine Liberation Organization tried to organize a similar boat to Palestine, and that boat was actually attacked. It was exploded. So we've had people on 24-hour watch, and before leaving each port, we've done dive checks. We've done our own dive checks in Cyprus. The Cypriot authorities volunteered to do that for us, so they checked out the bottom of our boats, and we were very adamant about wanting them to also give our boats a clean bill of health so that Israel cannot say that they're preventing us from going in because of any kind of security reason. So they checked our boats, they checked all of our belongings, everything we have on board, and have said that there are no weapons or there aren't any other contraband. And hopefully if the bottom of the boat check was clear, then these vessels are good to go. And we're going to keep sailing until we reach Gaza or until, you know, Israel decides to, what they've said is that they're going to forcefully block us. If they do blockade us, we are prepared to stay out at sea for as long as our water and our food holds out. If we start to run low, we will go back to Cyprus, we will restock, and we will come back out, insisting that we have a right to go through. As long as there isn't any kind of security concern, Israel cannot completely isolate the Palestinian people, the Gazan people, and cut them off from the rest of the world. Now, the other possibility is that they could decide to, they can decide to fire at us, they can decide to shoot at us, or they can decide to forcefully board our boats and arrest us. Again, this will be illegal. We constitute no security threat. And actually, we invite, we're leading the way right now. Any other vessel, anyone that has a boat that wants to come join us, we invite them to.
Huwaida Araf, we are moving on to our next segment. If you all could reach the other boat, tell them we are trying to reach them. We'll try to reach Lauren Booth and Jeff Halper later in the broadcast. Huwaida Araf is a human rights activist, co-founder of International Solidarity Movement. She teaches human rights law at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. She is in the Mediterranean Sea right now on the Liberty. Two boats, the Liberty and Free Gaza, are attempting to make their way from Cyprus, where they just set sail, to Gaza. The website is freegaza.org. We'll try to reach them later in the broadcast. Thank you for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. As the death toll escalates in Afghanistan, we'll talk about the situation with Sonali Kalhatkar. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting on over 700 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our transcripts are also there, and you can get our headlines in Spanish, and any radio station can take the audio version of the Spanish headlines, as over 200 are. Juan?
Well, NATO has denied a report in the French newspaper Le Monde that 10 French soldiers killed in Afghanistan earlier this week died as a result of friendly fire from Allied planes. A NATO spokeswoman said Thursday that Le Monde's claims were, quote, completely unfounded. The Le Monde report had quoted French soldiers who had survived the Taliban ambush. The soldiers told the newspaper that NATO planes arrived 4 hours after the ambush and accidentally hit French troops. French President Nicolas Sarkozy visited survivors in Kabul earlier this week and vowed to continue the fight against terrorism. He said no regrets about the sending of 700 additional troops to Afghanistan despite the soldiers' deaths. At a memorial service in France Thursday, Sarkozy justified maintaining the French presence in Afghanistan.
Nous n'avons pas le droit de renoncer à défendre nos valeurs.
We do not have the right to give up on our values. We do not have the right to let the barbarians triumph, because a defeat at the other end of the world will be paid by defeat here on the territory of the French Republic.
We're joined now from Burbank, California, by Sonali Kalhatkar. She's the host of Uprising on Pacifica radio station KPFK and co-author of Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. She's also co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, a group that works in solidarity with Afghans to help improve health and educational facilities for Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Sonali Kalhatkar, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy and Juan.
The situation right now in Afghanistan.
Well, it's getting worse in a nutshell. If you want to look at how things have changed over the past few years, you can simply look at how the Afghan people themselves have changed their minds about the U.S. occupation. Just in 2005, there was almost a 70% approval rating of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan because Afghans thought maybe things would get better if the foreign troops were present and they could be a buffer to the fundamentalist forces. In 2007, just a year ago, that approval rating was down to 40%, and I believe it's probably a lot lower right now. I mean, basically, what's happening is Afghan people are caught between a variety of forces, ordinary Afghans. They're caught on the one hand between the forces of the Taliban, who are increasing in number and strength. If you just look at the way in which they launched these recent attacks against the French, at the same time, they had a series of suicide bombers going to attack a U.S. base in a geographically separate location. This means they can launch, you know, simultaneous attacks at the same time in different areas. This means they're very strong. And of course, U.S. and NATO U.S. and NATO forces are attacking, and they're killing civilians. So far, 2,500 people have been killed in Afghanistan since January, about half of them civilians. So Afghan people are feeling the brunt of that very seriously because attacks against forces are up and attacks from forces are up. So the violence is really escalating. Then on the other hand, you have this other aspect that's rarely covered by the U.S. media, certainly never mentioned by government officials here, which is that the Afghan central government, created and installed essentially by the United States, is really devastating the people of Afghanistan. There's rampant corruption. They're sucking away the aid. They're completely oppressing people. They're attacking journalists. Women are being imprisoned in greater numbers than ever before for the crime of escaping from home or having quote-unquote sexual relations, illegal sexual relations. Most of these women are simply victims of rape. And so you have all of these forces that are converging upon the Afghan people from different directions, and life for the ordinary, average ordinary Afghan has gone from bad to so much worse in a very short period of time.
One of the things that the Bush administration repeatedly pointed to was the supposed liberation of the women of Afghanistan as a result of the U.S. Invasion and the replacement of the Taliban. What is your sense of what is actually going on at the grassroots level with women in Afghanistan?
Well, there's several aspects to it. You know, on the one hand, you have to look at how Afghan women are affected on a day-to-day level. Day-to-day level, of course, they're suffering the terrible effects of grinding poverty. There's hardly, you know, food and water and employment. Only 10% of Afghans have electricity. So Afghan women are suffering the same thing that all Afghans are suffering in terms of poverty and all of the things that go along with that. On top of that, of course, they face increasing fundamentalist forces from the government and from the insurgency, quote-unquote, the Taliban, in terms of repressive Islamist-type decrees. You know, they have to increasingly worry about Sharia law or strict interpretations, rather, of Sharia law. And then they face a very fundamentalist judiciary that was installed by our puppet president, Hamid Karzai. And then politically, Afghan women enjoy political equality with men in their constitution. It's enshrined in the new constitution, which is, of course, a wonderful thing, but the constitution is just a piece of paper. If you look at what happens on the ground, politically speaking, women who are in parliament, if they speak up, are completely attacked. And the best example of that is a woman I know that has been interviewed on Democracy Now! Before, Malalai Joya, the young social worker from Farah province, who has very bravely spoken out against warlordism in the parliament and, you know, has really been the voice of the people for speaking out. She has been banned from parliament and is yet to be reinstated. She faces an Islamic court, and that's the price that women pay politically for speaking out. It's okay for women to be in government as long as they shut up and stay quiet, but if they exercise their rights, they get attacked. I mean, that's basically what women are facing in Afghanistan. Not that much better than what they were facing under the Taliban. Certainly, they can legally wear whatever they want to wear, but oppression and freedom is a lot more about wearing or not being able to wear a burqa.
Sonali Kolhatkar, the resignation of the general, Pervez Musharraf, the president of Pakistan. Pakistan has long been funding through its ISI, the intelligence services, and actually from U.S. money, billions have been lost. But working with the Taliban, can you talk about that relationship and the significance of the resignation of Musharraf?
Well, Musharraf's resignation is interesting because it basically, I think, is a symbol, it's a symptom of how untenable the situation has become. And the relationship between, of course, Pakistan and Afghanistan is one significant part of why Musharraf resigned. His government and its support for, and the ISI support for the Taliban over the years has become something that is pretty much intolerable, both at home, but also by the U.S. government. And really what's happening in terms of, if you're looking at Afghanistan, is the Taliban are able to organize simply by crossing the border into Pakistan. And you can't fight an insurgency if they're free to go and organize and recruit and do whatever they need to do. In fact, of course, you can't really fight an insurgency with pure military power anyway, but that's another story. And so where Pakistan is concerned, I think the main significance of Musharraf resigning is it now opens up a political vacuum in Pakistan where the Pakistani government has to decide what to do about the problem of the Taliban. Do they want the Taliban to be, you know, to have an organizing base in their country, which of course increases the instability in Pakistan itself and certainly worsens the situation in Afghanistan? It's up to Pakistan to crack down on its borders if they want to. It's up to Pakistan to decide what to do with the Taliban, but it's also more complex than that. The Taliban are Pashtun people. A lot of Pakistanis are Pashtun. The Pashtun population was cut in half by the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan on purpose to destabilize that region, of course, if you go back in history. And so you can't really separate the Taliban from Pakistan either. It's a problem that I'm not sure has a clear answer, but really it's up to the new Pakistani government to decide what to do with the mess that essentially Musharraf created. Also, you know, of course, Musharraf has been Washington's man, so they really have to decide what to do now in the vacuum left behind by him.
The heroin trade, it's been exploding since the occupation of Afghanistan. Why, in your sense, is thousands of foreign troops in Afghanistan, yet the trade continues to explode in size?
Well, you have to go back and see what has happened over the past several years. When the Taliban were defeated in late 2001, the United States and the UN at the time, which was then replaced by NATO, had an opportunity to, you know, make things right, if you will, in terms of what was happening on the ground, in terms of poppy production, because the Taliban had done a good job for them. The Taliban had already banned opium production, and if the U.S. had gone from that point onwards in terms of giving farmers an alternative to poppy production, an alternative that could feed their families, we wouldn't be at the place we were today. But the United States chose to work with local Afghan warlords, commanders, militia leaders, all of whom were either drug traffickers themselves or working with drug traffickers, and turned a blind eye in many cases to opium production. The poppy production flourished in the last several years under U.S. occupation and now is out of control and now is very much funding the insurgency, very much funding the Taliban and their war. So the Taliban has an organizing base in Pakistan. They've got a stable source of funding with the opium production, and for every civilian killed or every Taliban fighter killed, there will be 10 more disgruntled, angry people to join their place. You can't blame them if you look at it from their perspective. So the Taliban has all these things going for them, and the U.S. and NATO and Obama actually thinks that they can defeat them militarily, which in my opinion is completely ludicrous and short-sighted.
Let's go to the candidates as we move into the Democratic and Republican conventions. Senator Obama's repeatedly called Afghanistan and its border with Pakistan the, quote, central front in the war on terror. He raised this again during a speech Tuesday at the Veterans of Foreign Wars convention.
We should not keep spending $10 billion a month in Iraq. We should not keep spending $10 billion a month in Iraq while Americans struggle in a sluggish economy. Ending the war will allow us to invest in America, to strengthen our military, and to finish the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan and the border regions of Pakistan. That is the central front in the war on terrorism. 4 years, I've called for more resources and more troops to finish the fight in Afghanistan. With his overwhelming focus on Iraq, Senator McCain argued that we could just, and I quote, muddle through in Afghanistan, and only came around to supporting my call for more troops last month.
Senator McCain's also brought up sending troop reinforcements to Afghanistan. This is an excerpt of his speech at a town hall in Albuquerque, New Mexico last month.
Senator Obama will tell you we can't win in Afghanistan without losing in Iraq. In fact, he has it exactly backwards. It is precisely the success of the surge in Iraq that shows us the way to succeed in Afghanistan. Our commanders on the ground in Afghanistan say that they need at least 3 additional brigades. Thanks to the success of the surge, these forces are becoming available, and our commanders in Afghanistan must get them.
The leading presidential candidates, Sonali Kahatkar, John McCain, and Senator Obama, what do you make of their approaches? Is there really a difference, ultimately?
Well, that's a really good question. It's so interesting to hear them try to distinguish themselves from each other. I mean, basically, in a nutshell, McCain thinks that the war in Afghanistan is going really well, and so we should send more troops. Obama thinks the war in Afghanistan is going badly, so we should send more troops. Obviously, both of them are wrong. I mean, if you just look at what McCain is saying, that Iraq is an example for how we can actually win in Afghanistan, I don't think I even have to qualify that to your listeners and viewers. But let's look at what Obama is saying. Obama is saying that Afghanistan is a front line in the war on terror. We should be sending more troops there. If he were to simply listen to, for example, what the RAND Corporation, not by any means a liberal think tank, what the RAND Corporation has said about using a military solution in Afghanistan, RAND just recently did a study about the situation in Afghanistan. And according to this institution, the military force is too blunt, in their words, an instrument to use in this war, that really the United States should not be using military force, that it has only something like a 7% chance of success. If anything, they say that the U.S.'s military footprint should be a very light one, if at all. So if Obama is listening to RAND, he would not be saying what he's saying. And it's true, you really can't solve the situation in Afghanistan by just throwing more troops at it, because over the last several years, tens of thousands of troops in Afghanistan have not managed to do anything other than worsen the war. So basically what the logic is that the war is going terribly. The more troops we have, the worse it's getting, so let's throw more troops to it. The predictable outcome of this policy, and, you know, I would love to get just a half a minute of airtime with Obama and tell him the predictable outcome of his policy is that you throw more troops at Afghanistan and the war is just going to get worse. The violence is just going to escalate. It's not going to ramp down. How can you just, what is he planning to do? Kill every last terrorist and then he's somehow going to win the war? What's the plan here? He doesn't even have a strategy. He isn't even looking at the central government. He's not looking at the corruption of the warlords. He's not looking at Hamid Karzai and what he has failed to do. He's not looking at how ordinary Afghans are struggling. He's not looking at the fact that the Taliban are actually becoming more and more popular while the troops are becoming less and less popular.
So, Nali,
what does that mean?
I'd like to ask you,
and Obama really needs to know.
So, Nali, one last question. Iran. The impact of the continuing U.S. occupation of Afghanistan on Iran, obviously Afghanistan borders with Iran, your sense is the United States is also continuing to use the occupation as a means of threatening or being able to encircle Iran?
Well, certainly what Afghanistan gives to the United States, particularly under the Bush administration, which has not been as interested in oil pipeline routes as it has been in military bases, it gives, of course, as you said, a launching pad, and it enables the United States to encircle Iran. When I was in Afghanistan a few years ago, we drove past a military base that used to be just a local airport near the border with Iran, and our driver told us, oh, yes, last month U.S. troops came and took over this base, and if they attack Iran, everyone knows that they're going going to probably do it from here as one of the places. McCain has said that he would like to see the military bases in Afghanistan become permanent. And this is very important because geopolitically, Afghanistan is crucial to the United States. Never before, until 2001, has the United States had military bases in the heart of Central Asia, in Russia's backyard, in China's backyard, and certainly, of course, in Iran's backyard. This is going to be something that the U.S. will make use of in the future, unless, of course, the American people stand up and say, get out of Afghanistan, which is what I think we should do.
Sonali Kahatkar, thank you very much for joining us, host of Pacifica Radio, KPFK's morning show called Uprising. She is co-author of Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. I want to warn our stations, we're going to be a little late with break because we have reached the other boat that has set sail from Cyprus to Gaza. This is Free Gaza. The other boat is Liberty, where we're speaking with Huwaida Araf. Lauren Booth is on the line with us now, journalist and broadcaster, also the sister-in-law of the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Lauren Booth, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain to us why you're on the Mediterranean Sea right now in the ship called Free Gaza.
Thanks very much for calling. I'm on the Mediterranean Sea in between Cyprus and Gaza. I don't want to say exactly where, because we are the Free Gaza movement, who I am joining to report on, is trying to break the blockade of Gaza that has been going on since 2006. Israel does not allow essential items into Gaza, increasing the suffering of an already impoverished people.
And could you tell us why you've decided personally to get involved? Obviously, you're a high-profile figure, and I'm sure that the former prime minister, your brother-in-law, has his own opinions of your actions.
It's his duty as Middle East envoy to be aware of movements like this who want to help the people that he's supposed to be partially representing. And unfortunately, Tony Blair has not been to Gaza in his role as Middle East envoy, so it's unclear how he can represent the Middle East on this important question of people being besieged in this almost medieval-style way is not addressed.
Is he supporting you in your effort to call attention to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza?
Can you say again? I missed that.
Is Tony Blair, your brother-in-law, supporting you in your effort to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza?
Well, you'd think that Tony Blair would support the Free Gaza movement in its peaceful mission, but I can't say that there's been any direct contact. What we do know is that Israel has been using a lot of diplomatic pressure to stop the mission from leaving Cyprus, from starting out in the Greek waters. But the Greek and the Cypriot governments and their local authorities were brilliant and very supportive.
What are you attempting to accomplish?
The most important thing that could be accomplished tomorrow when we arrive in Gaza waters is an open contact between Gaza and the rest of the world. Economically, it would be great for them to start exporting. They have some wonderful produce. They have olive oil that they need to send out to the world. They have people who need to come and share their lives. They have voices that need to be heard. And let's hope that this is the first boat to do that in 40 years.
We're talking to Lauren Booth on the Mediterranean Sea. They've just set sail from Cyprus, heading to Gaza. We were speaking with Huwaida Araf on the Liberty, the sister fishing boat that's been converted to go on this trip. She was talking about death threats before you left. Are you concerned about your safety, Lauren Booth?
There have been some very strange situations in the last few days. Yes, my family were called at home and told that the boats would certainly be blown up when they reached Gaza. Other people who are Palestinian families have been under a great deal of pressure not to take part. And we've had some of our machinery interfered with and sabotaged. And just this morning, the Port Authority told us that there were Mossad agents operating in their ports that they were very unhappy with. And that is why the secret authorities escorted us out. We had police escorts all the way out to Cypriot waters. So there is interference already going on.
Well, Lauren Booth, we understand you're also there with Jeff Halper, the Israeli professor of anthropology and coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Would it be possible to pass the phone to him that we might talk to him for a minute?
I shall pass you on to Jeff, who looks like an old sea salt, a real old sailor is here. He's just staggering Captain Birdseye. If anybody knows Captain Birdseye, I'll pass Jeff Halper over, the esteemed Jeff Halper.
We're talking to Jeff Halper and Lauren Booth on the Free Gaza boat that is headed to Gaza. Jeff Halper, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain why you're on the boat and what the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, why this group is supporting this trip?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
Jeff, explain why you're on the boat.
What?
Explain why you are on the boat.
I'm the only Israeli Jew on board this mission. You spoke to Hueda, I guess, who's also Israeli, but is actually Palestinian. She just has Israeli passport. So I think it's very important to be an Israeli presence, because after all, we're the occupying power. And we have to take responsibility. And so, in a sense, symbolically, my presence here is a taking of responsibility by Israelis for the occupation and for the siege and the oppression for which we put the Palestinians under.
Jeff, some of the press reports have indicated you also have a Holocaust survivor among those who are as part of the mission. Could you tell us about that person?
Yeah, her name is Hetty Epstein. She actually, she didn't join the ship. She fainted a couple days ago. She's 84 years old, and there was some concern about her health. But she's been with us for the last 3 weeks and fully intended to come. Again, as a kind of a moral witness of a Jew, of a Jewish person who's gone through the Holocaust, who feels a sense of responsibility towards what we're doing to the Palestinians.
Jeff Halper,
Jews and Israeli Jews, and that is that we have to begin to take responsibility. We can't always present ourselves as the victims. We're not the weak party, and we have to take responsibility for what we're doing. And that's, I think, our central message to our own people.
Jeff, we have to wrap right now, and we're going to follow this journey you all take in these two fishing boats. But we're headed to the Democratic and Republican conventions. What message do you have for Barack Obama and Senator John McCain from the Mediterranean Sea?
Well, you know, I don't expect from American politicians much in the way of justice or human rights. To tell you the truth, I think the way an American president could break through on this issue is to present it in American terms. If whoever gets elected gets up and says, this occupation, this conflict is the epicenter of instability in the Middle East, which is what James Baker called it, and it is absolutely counterproductive to American interests. And I am the American president, I'm not the Israeli president, and this occupation simply has to cease for American interests. I believe the vast majority of Congress and the American people would support that. That's the only way to break through. As long as you look at Israel as an ally in the war on terror and Hamas and all that stuff, Israel has an upper hand, and human rights and justice get trampled underfoot. So I think framing it in an American way is the approach that I would suggest to these guys, because they're not going to take a human rights approach.
Jeff Halper, I want to thank you for being with us. We will be in touch with you soon next week. Jeff Halper, Israeli professor of anthropology, coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Before that, Lauren Booth, journalist and broadcaster, sister-in-law of the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are coming up on the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. There is a new film out. It's called Trouble the Water. We'll be joined by the filmmaker. Stay with us. Hurricane Waters by Citizen Cope. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, next week marks the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. President Bush visited New Orleans Wednesday and lauded the recovery of the city, saying, quote, hope is marching in. But that isn't quite as clear to many of the city's residents who are still unable to find jobs or afford housing. In a report to be released Tuesday, Oxfam America details how much more needs to be done to bring back hope to the city, noting that 35,000 people are still living in FEMA trailers and only 12% of returning African-American evacuees can find jobs.
Today, we're joined by the makers of a film that takes us back 3 years, back inside the hurricane and the many forms of devastation that followed. Trouble the Waters, the name of the film. It follows a couple from New Orleans' Ninth Ward, aspiring rap musician Kimberly Rivers Roberts and her husband Scott Roberts. They return home 2 weeks after the hurricane. But it begins with footage shot by the couple who documented the approach of the hurricane and the moment the flood waters began to rise. This is an excerpt from the trailer of the film.
My name is Scott Michael Roberts. This is my wife, Kimberly Roberts. We're from New Orleans, the Ninth Ward, underwater.
And they say on the news that it's like aiming toward Mississippi, so we might get the outskirts.
It's the sky. It looks pretty now. But it sure soon will change.
Girl, I hear some thunder.
Golly! Look at that water, boy! Woo, Lord!
Dog, you see how hot it is?
Please, all this water coming through the windows.
Hey, help us get off the roof, man. You're a real hero, boy.
We under siege, truly under siege. Everybody done lost everything around here.
Now, you have seen what Katrina has done to us. She stuck us in her attic. I'm running out of juice, too.
These houses have not been inspected yet. There could be dead people right now as we speak, because the National Guard, they have not been here. And it's 2 weeks after the hurricane.
Ooh, don't come around, yeah, if you try to
trouble the waters.
And this is one of the Navy bases that Bush had planned to close down.
Why can't we stay overnight?
What about the women and children? They said, get off our property or we're going to start shooting.
We don't need
the trailer for Trouble the Water won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance Festival this year, opening night tonight here in New York at the IFC Theater. It's opening in Los Angeles as well, being released with a national rollout in September. We're joined now by the film's co-directors and co-producers, Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. They also produce Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 and Bowling for Columbine. Welcome to Democracy Now! What an astounding film. What an astounding woman that she got the camera. When did she get?
She bought a camera on the street about a week before the storm. She wasn't intending to chase the storm. She wasn't, you know, she bought it for, it was a good value, and she was looking to tape family events and birthday parties. It so happened that, you know, when Katrina hit, she and about 100,000 others weren't able to leave the city because they had no public transportation, no means to get out, and the city hadn't provided for their evacuation.
How'd you find Kimberly?
We were, Carl and I went to Central Louisiana about 10 days after the storm. You know, Bush 2 days ago was commending the Louisiana National Guardsmen for their work rescuing. Well, they were actually in Iraq at the time of the storm, and Carl and I went down to Central Louisiana to tape their homecoming. It was about 10 days after the storm. And at one point, the National Guard shut us down because we had found out that the high water vehicles were in Iraq along with the National Guard, and they didn't like the questions we were asking. Carl wandered over to the Red Cross shelter, and Kimberly wandered right up into our frame and started to tell her story on camera.
And then you decided to follow her and her efforts as well?
Yeah, well, look, when we met Kimberly and Scott, it was, they had just come out of hell, right? And they presented themselves with incredible optimism at the same time, and invited us along to see what was going to happen next with their lives. We didn't know where the story was going to go.
This is a part of the film that was shot by Kimberly Roberts.
Oh, Jesus! This is my face. After just opening my back door, who be with us for the police? Man, I'm talking about niggas going to take a dip if they want.
This is astounding footage. I mean, when she first meets you, she said, I've got stuff that I haven't seen anywhere.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And Amy, you did some of the very best reporting on the Gulf Coast at the time of Katrina. But the rest of the media was showing you the outside looking in. And Kimberly's footage gives us an opportunity to see what happened from the inside, you know, looking out.
You go beyond the hurricane, and you follow them in this journey afterwards and seeking help. You have an amazing scene where Sam, where Kimberly's husband,
Scott,
where Scott describes going to the naval yard. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, there's a naval support activity building in the Ninth Ward. A lot of people don't know that. It was the only building in New Orleans that actually had power. In the days after Katrina, there was one light up there. You had the light of the moon and the stars, then you had the light at the naval base. And after their second day of no rescue coming, Kimberly and Scott led a group of several hundred people to the naval base, right up to the gate, and they knew they had empty rooms there. It turns out it's kind of a barracks. And they were turned
hundreds,
away.
Hundreds of rooms.
And they were turned away at gunpoint. And later we went back and spoke with some of the sailors who were at the base and the CO, and they said we were just doing our job, which was protecting the interests of the U.S. government. Somehow the interests of the U.S. government isn't looking out for the best interests of its own citizens.
And this is one aspect of the catastrophe that never got any coverage, as far as I can recall, of citizens being turned away at that barracks.
You know, we've heard the story from a dozen people, you know, who were there. Eyewitnesses, and it has been reported elsewhere.
Yeah. You got to see it in the movie in order to see it.
We want to have you back next week at the Democratic Convention. Why are you going there?
You know, we've been invited to show the film to the Democratic National Convention and to the Republican National Convention delegates. It is an important film as we lead up into the election. We need to remind, you know, the delegates that Katrina people are still struggling, that Katrina existed before the storm, that Kimberly and Scott have weathered many storms in their lives, and they're eager to tell the delegates.
So you're
that.
Showing it to the delegates on Wednesday across from the convention center.
That's
we hope
right.
to have you on with Kimberly and Scott again next week. I hope we can.
Wonderful.
But that wraps up this section of the show. The film opens tonight in Los Angeles and in New York. Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl are the co-directors and producers of Trouble the Water. Remarkable film that it is, as we head now to Denver. Democracy Now! Expanding to 2 hours daily for the upcoming conventions in both Denver. Then we head to St. Paul. Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency is our broadcast. We'll be broadcasting from both cities, from the streets to the suites to the convention floors, August 25th to September 5th. If your station is not running the broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, but many are. Just ask them about the listings and the times they'll be running the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday to Eva Lewis, Julie Crosby, and Vesta Goddard.